Welcome. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the Bay Area Book Festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I'm going to introduce our authors to you and just tell you a little bit about them before we begin. I have them on my list alphabetically, so I'll start with Yangtze Chu. Is the New York Times best-selling author of The Ghost Bride, soon to be a Netflix original series. And The Night Tiger, which was just chosen as a Reese Witherspoon Hello Sunshine Book Club pick. So two kind of awesome things for your books. It was also an Amazon Spotlight pick for Best Book of the Month. Yangtze loves to eat and read and often does both at the same time. On the end, we have Terry Gamble. She was born in Pasadena, California, the younger of two daughters of resolutely Victorian parents. You guys are really good at your bios. Her first two novels, The Water Dancers and Good Family, are based in northern Michigan, where she spent her childhood summers. Her most recent novel, The Eulogist, is set in Cincinnati, Ohio, where her ancestors landed when they immigrated from Northern Ireland in 1819. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Michigan, Terry lives in Northern California with her artist husband and an ancient cat. Next to me is Christopher Tillman. He's the author of two short story collections, In a Father's Place and The Way People Run, and three previous novels, The Right Hand Shore, Mason's Retreat, and Roads of the Heart. He is a professor of English at the University of Virginia and lives with his wife, novelist Caroline Preston, in Charlottesville, Virginia, and in Centerville, Maryland. His new historical fiction novel is Thomas and Beale in the Midi. And I was telling our authors, you know, it was such a treat to get their books. Sometimes when you moderate these panels, you get books and you think, yeah, I don't really love this. But I really loved all of these. So it was a real joy. Before we begin, I'm curious, who here in this audience writes historical fiction? Okay, great. Who is planning to write historical fiction? Anyone? Excellent. And who is a reader of historical fiction? Okay, good work. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to try to make sure that I ask questions that address things that you all will want to know. And I'm going to save a little extra time for questions at the end, since we have so many historical fiction writers here. And I'm hoping that this will go as a conversation between us here on the stage and then a conversation with you out there. So think of questions. Mm-hmm. Our books today are literally all over the map, both in time and place. From colonial Malaysia to antebellum Ohio to France at the turn of the last century. And to kick things off, I'd like to ask each of you guys, what inspired you to write this book? And in particular, what made you choose this time and place? Do you want to start on the end with Terry?
Certainly. Well, thank you, Janice, and thank you all for coming. It's great to see so many readers of historical fiction. I had not intended to write a book of historical fiction, and after I'd finished my last projects, I was kind of rooting around for a new project, and my father passed away, and my sister and I were going through his effects, and we found a letter between who would have been my great-great-great uncle and a monument maker in Boston commissioning an obelisk to be erected at the Spring Grove Cemetery in Cincinnati, Ohio. And if you've made it if you're dead in Spring Grove Cemetery. And I decided to save the letter, but then I was also going to pitch out. There were all these receipts. And then I looked more closely at them, and they were receipts for bodies that were being exhumed, so it would be consolidated in this cemetery. And I started to ask myself, I think as so many of us are asking ourselves now, about why did our family immigrate to begin with, and what were their feelings, what were their experiences when they got here, My family had immigrated from Northern Ireland, meaning they were Protestant Irish, which means they had come from Scotland in the 1600s to Ireland. They were, you know, colonists, and then they come to the United States because of a climate. Basically because there was a climate event. A volcano halfway around the world exploded, and their crops failed. So I wanted to investigate what they encountered, how they made their way in this country, with immigration such a big issue now. And mostly I was interested in what did they think about slavery, because Cincinnati is just a short width of the river across from the slave state of Kentucky. And it got me curious. And that's how I started.
I love when writing fiction helps you understand something from the real world. I think it's one of the great gifts of being a fiction writer. When you want to figure something out, you decide to make up a story about it. That's excellent. Yanksy, what about you?
Hi. Is it on?
Doesn't sound like it.
I think it is, though.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much for having me here, and thank you for this great panel, actually. I'm originally from Malaysia, and they do say write what you know, so I thought I would not be able to write a historical novel about Ohio, for example. But Malaysia is an interesting country. It has been colonized by the Dutch, the Portuguese, and the British. And one of the things that they have left, particularly the British, were very large colonial houses, right? Really beautiful houses built for the tropics, built in the time of the British Raj, when the sun did not set on the empire. So, and growing up, and even to this day in Malaysia, you can see a lot of these very old, sprawling houses that were clearly built for another era. You know, they've got high ceilings and they have servants' quarters. Because in those days, to run a house like that, you need lots and lots of servants. So when I was a little girl, my father was a civil servant, and he was able to rent one of these smaller houses. It was called a C-class bungalow. It was A and B, according to your civil service rank. And for a short while, we lived in a small version of one of these when I was a kid. And it was set in the middle of the jungle, and it was filled with animals. You know, there were monitor lizards outside, there were wild chickens, a large toad lived in the bathroom. It would come out every time you had a sluice bath. That means you've got a large tub of water and you fill it, and then you sort of, you know, bathe yourself like that. And I was really worried about that toad, but, you know, my dad, I was three at the time, my dad said, that toad is probably older than you, so you should leave it alone. And the sense of living in that house was so interesting and so magical. I think it was actually a real trial for my mom, because she said when they moved in that there were so many termites that she thought would collapse on us. And one day someone rode by on a bicycle and stole all my father's shirts off the washing line. So I think it was a real trial for my mom. But as a child, it was a fascinating world. And at the back of this little house, which was so small, there were servants' quarters. I thought, this is very odd, you know. And years later, my parents had said, oh, this was very normal in those days. Like, even if you were running a bachelor establishment, you would have servants' quarters. So years later, I put in a lot of the things that I love and are interested in, such as twins and Chinese dance halls. And this strange world of servants and masters into a novel about these great houses, some of which were very large, as you might consider like a Downton Abbey of the tropics or something like that. And I did wonder, in those houses, like, because people were divided not just by class and race, but by language, you know, the masters may have had no idea what the local people were saying about them. And so it's a murder mystery and a ghost story, and well, I hope I enjoyed doing it. I hope you do too.
How do I do this one?
Yeah.
So, yes, thank you very much for coming. What a nice crowd. I came all the way from Virginia for this, so what a pleasure. My novel's about an interracial couple escaping from Maryland to France in 1892. A white boy and a black girl. I use the word boy and girl advisedly. Their youth and extreme youth is sort of part of the story. It's really, this book is part of kind of a series. I don't call it anything, but it's Chronologically, it's kind of between a novel I published in 2012 called The Right Hand Shore and a novel I published in 1996 called Mason's Retreat, which was really the one that started it, although it's the last in time. So every time I write a new one, I have to go do a new edition of Mason's Retreat to change it. And my publisher thus far has had a good sense of humor about it. All of this is following stories about a farm in the Eastern Shore, Maryland, for those of you on this coast, but you know about bays, you know about sides of bays. Eastern Shores is the side of the Chesapeake Bay, otherwise known as the Eastern Shore. And about a farm that my family has been on for many centuries and that my brothers and I now own. It's a grain farm, had been a dairy farm for many years, and we do organic grain now. But still, so all the stories in these books are really harvested from family tales. My brothers read them and they say, "He did not." And this one is no different. This story of the interracial couple came out of a story of the young man who was the scion of the family in the early 1890s who fell in love with a black servant. And they weren't able to work this out, obviously, and he shot himself, killed himself in a room upstairs in the house my brother now lives in. Of the woman, the girl, it won't surprise you, we know nothing. And for a fiction writer, not knowing is where things start to get interesting. So what this novel really is me trying to give them the life they never got to live. It sends them to France because that's where they could live as husband and wife. And it involves, in The Right Hand Shore, I got them as far as the boat escaping. And this picks up on the other side of the Atlantic being met by a nun. There's sort of a certain amount of Catholic help going on in here, Catholic Maryland, after all. And so it really involves them first going to Paris and trying to figure out what they're going to do. And Thomas is, in theory, going to find some way for them to live and decide on something. And here's this 19-year-old farm girl going to Paris, and how is she going to survive? And kind of to my surprise in writing it over many years, I worked very slowly, she thrives in Paris. And one of the reasons that she does is because she has to be beautiful, right? Otherwise, why write it? And and she becomes a favorite of the artists, the American artist community, and they're all trying to paint her portrait. And I could talk more about that. That's an interesting moment in Paris. I'll talk about that later if someone asks. So he finally decides that he's going to go into growing grapes, and he buys a vineyard in a part of France called Languedoc, and this is the Midi. The Midi means really, if you think, it means the south in France, but if you talk about the Midi, you're saying the deep south. So in this case, this is the far western part, just above Spain. So this is a rough territory, but a huge sort of wine area. And so that's what they do. They have their little interlude in Paris and end up on the farm, which was, of course, the one place Beale wanted to avoid ever going back to.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's so interesting because all of you, a lot of what prompted your books were family stories and tied to your family. I had a similar thing with A Master Plan for Rescue, which was inspired a lot by my father's stories of being a boy in New York City during World War II. Mm-hmm. And that sort of jumped me in. I hadn't really thought of this before, but those of you who have thinking about writing historical fiction or are, how many of you are tapping into family stories? Yeah, okay. I think it's not uncommon and very interesting. What a surprise.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I think families are less than happy to have writers in their ranks. The last time I moderated this panel, I began a question for the panel by saying, as writers of historical fiction, which was then followed by every single writer on the panel insisting they were not a writer of historical fiction, despite the fact that all their books took place in the distant past. I have a hunch that so much of that reaction was based on the fact that historically, historical fiction was sort of on a par with romance and not considered very literary. Although I can only imagine that a book like All the Light We Cannot See, which is historical fiction and won the Pulitzer the year it came out, might change that a bit. Certainly all of these books are very literary. They are not romance, although they have romance in them. Do you guys consider yourselves writers of historical fiction? And have you ever been embarrassed by the designation? Huh. You sound like you're ready.
No, I don't consider myself a writer of historical fiction. I just happened to find a story that was set a long time ago. And I am absolutely determined to write my next book that in a time that has electricity. But there is some comfort in writing about the distant past when we come to these family issues, because no one can say, no, they didn't, because no one knows. I wrote the two other books that I wrote weren't as distant, and one drew heavily from family experience, and that led to a lot of awkwardness and people wondering if that's, was that me? How could you do that? I never did cocaine. So this was a little safer. No one is critical about it. But so I don't feel embarrassed. I'm fine with it. Anything to get me on a panel with you.
All right, Yangtze, what do you think?
I actually don't mind being called a historical fiction author. I'm very happy to be an author at all. I know. People had said to me, why do you have... I think because, I never thought I would be published. And when one is looking at the publishing industry, it seems insurmountable. The hurdles that one reads about seem very difficult. So I thought, when I wrote my first book, that no one is ever going to read this book about a marriage of the dead that occurs in some obscure custom in a little Southeast Asian country. No one's ever going to read, so it's okay, And when I actually tried to become a writer, I literally Googled it. I Googled, how do you publish a book? Oh, okay, right. So, and Google is your friend. Google said you need to submit a query letter. And then I Googled, how do you write a query letter? And I came out of the slush pile, as many, many of my author friends did. So for all of you who are out there writing, I'd like to encourage you. There are many, many of us. So,
you had no agent?
And I did. The query letter found me an agent. My agent is the one who sold my books. So it's all thanks to her. And so I'm happy to be called a historical fiction author. I have actually encountered the question, as perhaps you guys have, of people asking, why are you writing in the past? And for me, I think I like to read a lot of historical fiction. When I was growing up, there weren't that many English books, and so I was forced to read and reread these Victorian novels that every small library has, like Middlemarch for some reason, and you're forced to read it. And also I think the past is another country. And the reason why I read, and perhaps many of you do, is to escape the present sometimes. And so that is also where some of my interests lie.
That's very interesting. I like that.
I have to follow right on that. Say I had a student that not long ago that kind of observed that novels that used to involve different places, but now the places are known, their landscapes are a pop-up on the screen anywhere. And so we're sort of searching for the otherness in the past now. I certainly have no trouble at all. Now I'm into this series. I'm probably going to be writing this to the end. If there's any kind of complaint about the subgenre I'm in among the kind of the literary and academic people I live with in Virginia, it's not really about history, it's about plot. It's about the plottedness and sort of how I think narrative works and how it functions and what arc is. But every time I finish one of these, my editor, Jonathan Galassi, says, I don't really like historical fiction. I said, well, Jonathan, why do you keep publishing me? And he said, well, I don't know. He says, well, it's a romance. And he doesn't mean romance fiction. He means the sort of 19th century sort of quest. And so I buy that. But really, when you think of it, my favorite historical novel is War and Peace. Mm-hmm. That was a historical novel 60 years after the Napoleonic War. Mm-hmm. The Scarlet Letter, 120 years mm-hmm. after those events. So the idea of writing about the past is very much with us. And it's really a sense that I have. My interest is if there are discrete moments, discrete chunks of time where something happened, that's historical fiction. So I look at, Anna Burns, The Milkman. I hope people are starting to read that. That's about Ireland in the 1870s, but it's about the Troubles. Mm-hmm. That's historical fiction as far as I'm concerned, because it really treats that time as it's with its own dynamics.
Mm, thank you. I know for myself, I often think when I'm reading historical fiction, it's sort of like a form of time travel. Mm-hmm. And writing it can be that too, because when you think, oh, I wish I'd always lived in this time period. I wish I'd always lived, New York City in the Jazz Age. When you write about it, it is almost like you are living that, which is really wonderful. I think one thing that, Yangtze, you said, it can be a retreat from the present. But I also think that as writers of historical fiction, we are often able to illuminate things in the present. In a really interesting, subtle way by writing about the past, because history does tend to repeat itself, which I think is an interesting way to approach it. Have any of you thought, while you were writing, I'm certainly with you in immigration, did things from the present come up and inform how you were writing?
Well, it took me so long to write this book that things kept happening that were just, I hadn't set out to write a book about the immigrant experience, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, climate change, and financial inequality. And then in the decade that in which I was, it took me to write this book, it was just that everything that we are dealing with in the present seems to have been litigated already in the 19th century. And here we are. Religiosity, extreme religious reaction to technology, upending life, populism, Jacksonian America. There's so many clues. And to what both Chris and Yangtze have said, that it's almost comforting in a weird way to understand that this is part of our DNA, that we have worked these things out before, that sometimes the pendulum swings really widely. And I hope we don't have to go through a civil war, because my book leads up to the Civil War. It sets the table for the Civil War. But there's a lot of the threads that are there, that were there then. And my narrator, she is assaulted in this book, spoiler alert, and had no recourse. She just better bury it, and then all of this stuff starts happening. So
yeah, I think that's because we read these books with, of course, eyes of this time, looking at the things that happened in the past, so they take on another resonance for us, which I think is important. An interesting thing that at first I thought all of you did, and then Terry has informed me that she did not do this, which is what I like to call writing in the opposite sex, writing from the point of view of a character of a different gender than your own. So Terry's book is, you get so close to a couple of the male characters that I was positive you had done it. So that, I think that's a testament to that book. But this can be very tricky for a writer, to write from the point of view of another gender. I know when I was writing Master Plan for Rescue, both the main characters, there's a 12-year-old boy and a young Jewish man. And I don't think I would have even tackled this had I not raised a son. Mm. And I felt like I might know some things about boys and young men by them. So I want to ask both Chris and Yangtze, what challenges did you face in writing in the opposite sex? And did you have any trepidation about doing it? And what do you think helped you pull it off? Because I think you certainly did.
No. Oh. Well, you know, I really have never even thought about it. It seems to me that this is the what fiction its duty and responsibility is to do, is to go as far outside of yourself as you can. In this case, I'm writing not only from the point of view of the opposite sex, but a different race. About a third of this is from Beale's point of view. And my feeling about that is really that I've spent about 15 years writing about these two characters in two books. I knew them as infants. You know, I knew them when they were born, and they weren't, you know, a white boy and a black girl. They were just babies. And so you kind of wonder, well, gee, now they're six. Does that mean that I don't understand them? Or now they're 12 and they're adolescents. Now they're 20. It just seemed where my story went. There are obviously questions about that, but I think that simply writing broadly is my reply to bigotry and hatred. Mm. So that's what I did. But the point is, I really never queried myself very much on it. I do get pushback from time to time. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Well, I'm sorry to say that I actually didn't write first person for the child in my book either, but it's very close third person,
yeah,
and you do
William.
Hear his thoughts. Yeah.
Yeah.
So half the book is actually written from the point of view of a dance hall girl, a Chinese dance hall girl, and the other part is the worldview of an 11-year-old houseboy in an age, the 1930s Malaya, when a houseboy was literally a boy, when you could have child servants. And, you know, when my mother herself did not go to school until she was 11. And when she was a little girl, she told me that she had a friend who was a few years older than her, maybe 12 or so, who was a servant in one of these big British houses. And one day, my mum went to visit her, and my mum was about 8 or so. And she went round to the kitchen, and her friend was very proudly showing, look at this kitchen, ooh, look at this, you know. And she said, I'll give you a treat. And she gave my mother a glass of ice water. And it was the first ice, my mom told me, she'd ever had in her life. Malaysia's a very hot country, it's like Florida. And she said it was shocking and absolutely amazing that there could be anything so cold in this world. And I also thought, thinking like, in those big houses, did those masters have any idea what was going on? Like, there's some kid running your kitchen, and then they let in these other kids, and they're all drinking your ice. So that was very interesting to me. And the thought of, you know, Janice, when you talked about your raising a son, my son was also about that age when I was writing this novel. And by the way, I'm really glad to hear from Terry and Chris that you also took years to write your books, because I'm very, very slow. So my son was growing up when I was writing this book, and the thoughts of a child are very interesting. To a certain degree, perhaps it is slightly gender neutral, because we've all been children. Mm-hmm. When I set him as an 11-year-old boy, I thought 11 is in some ways the peak of childhood. You have not hit puberty yet. So at 11, you are large enough and strong enough to do many things. You know, you can actually do lots and lots of household work. My mom told me when she was 6 that she could catch and kill and pluck and dress a chicken, because that was what she did for her family. My grandfather was a tin miner. And you're physically capable of doing a lot, and you also are full of this confidence. I think 11-year-olds have not hit like this kind of what is it called, tween, I'm not wearing the right clothes and the shoes are not cool. You know, at 11, you're at the peak of being a child. And so I actually enjoyed writing that character. And at the same time, I think as a reader, when you read that character, you also understand that he's making assumptions that you as an adult wouldn't. So in the book, Ren says that his new master, British doctor, is so reasonable, he's so sane. But as the reader, you actually know that William is actually falling apart. So it is interesting to see the child's perspective versus the adult as well.
Yeah. So, Terry, you said you had something to add to this as we talked before.
Well, when we were talking before, I said that's interesting you thought that I wrote it from the male point of view, because I did originally. And I wrote multiple points of view, and that was the only way I could see of designing this novel, because you had to get these, I wanted these situations to have occurred that did not feel a female character could have been there. especially in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote, the opening scene was somebody recounting their own birth, but the aunt was there. And I was just on a tear, and I sent some pages off to my editor. I was about 2 years in, and she came back and she goes, "It's great, except I think you need to write this whole book from the point of view of the sister. It sounds so easy to change." Right? So 7 years later, yeah. So, but because of writing, no writing is wasted. And all of those scenes that I wrote with these brothers who get to, you know, cavort up and down the Ohio River and go here and there, at least I knew that those experiences had happened, and to the extent that I could surface them in conversation in the book, or her imagining, or her actually intruding herself and, you know, getting herself to a revival with her itinerant minister brother. Mm-hmm. It was great. But I'm so curious about Christopher saying, writing this, you know, when you write from the point of view of another gender, or you write from another race, this is a touchy topic right now.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I have this conversation all the time. And I think, you know, well, you know, as writers, what is our strength supposed to be? And it's empathy. Mm-hmm. And if we can't feel empathy or imagine something, how can we restrict ourselves to only our own experience if we can't conjure that? So I think that's a very interesting topic.
Yeah. And you are actually on to my next question, which was that topic exactly. And Christopher began to touch on it because he writes from Beale's point of view, who is an African-American young woman. And, you know, as writers and readers, we talk a lot these days about cultural appropriation and trying to figure out how to sort of balance this intersection between appropriation and imagination. And I think also, as part of our job as fiction writers, is to imagine what the world is like from someone with different experiences and a different point of view. And as I think you said really aptly, empathy. So it is a really charged topic. And I wonder, Christopher, if you had concerns about this, or felt like on some level you didn't have permission to write from Beale's point of view?
No, I didn't. I didn't have any concerns. I know the sort of the changing environment. When I started doing this in 1996 or 1993 with my first book, This has always been a sort of series of books in black and white, because there are black families and white families that are intimately related in this part of Maryland and on my family's place. So there was sort of no way you could sort of pretend half the world didn't exist. And really, I find it an interesting question. When I got on the plane yesterday in Charlottesville, my wife said, "Don't talk about cultural appropriation."
Well, you didn't.
I can say someone else raised it, but I will only say this one slight. I'd be very interested to talk to any of you afterwards about it. But I'll tell you one thing from the point of view of someone that runs a Master of Fine Arts program in fiction. Our students, these are 25, 30, 35-year-old, very talented people, and they don't know what to write about. They are sort of more and more into this, what I consider a cul-de-sac of kind of auto-fiction, and they're really one of the responses to some of this sort of less considered pushback is to have no characters, just to pretend that no characters of a different race even exist. Mm. They're writing about worlds that are intolerable to me. Yeah. And so we have wonderful debates. I enjoy it. I mean, I'm kind of a wonk when it comes to all this stuff. But that's you know, it's where it's at.
Yeah. Well, you know, I my book I wrote from the point of view of a Jewish man. I am not Jewish, which surprised many JCCs who had me come and talk. But it was interesting because it was, for me, the reaction was very much people were happy. Because I was writing about the refugee ship, the St. Louis, and they were very happy I was bringing this topic up. Yangtze, and you write in your book from the point of view of William in some chapters. We're really in his head and his opinions and view of the world. And this is a sort of British colonialist. How is that for you? Because that's a different sort of ethnicity for you to be writing, and sort of different than your family's background.
Yes. So there is a character in my novel called William Acton, and he is a British doctor in colonial Malaysia. And he sort of feels like he's God to a certain degree because he's running this hospital. Was it hard to write? Yes and no. You know, I mentioned earlier that when I was growing up, there wasn't a great variety of books to read. And some of the books I had to read were Somerset Maugham. It was like lots and lots of Somerset Maugham. And I read all of them thinking that this is a really... And for a long time, that's really what you could get from Malaysia. Or, you know, literature about Malaysia was seen through the eyes of people like Somerset Maugham. And... So when I started writing William, to a certain degree, like the 30s cadence, like the way they talked, so the sort of slang they used, not very much slang, came through. And I felt like I knew this person, William, because this feckless doctor has shown up in so many Somerset Maugham novels in which he's having affairs with lots of women and may or may not have a dirty secret in England. Mm-hmm. You know, so I did feel to a certain degree that I knew him quite well. But I tried to avoid having long monologues in his head. I thought it worked better if I only did his thoughts under certain, like, moments of duress. Mm-hmm. And because I don't think I could have sustained these long monologues. This is, perhaps a writing craft question. But when they got too long... my husband was like, this is now turning to pastiche. You need to stop. So yes and no, I think. Mm-hmm.
And I like what you're saying about also how your reading informed your writing and characters you create. And I think that's something that we don't talk enough about as writers, how important reading is and what you read. And whatever you're reading, particularly when you're writing, bleeds into your writing. Which is why it makes sense to always read books you think are good when you are writing. Right. Or suddenly, if you're not, you'll find some really bad dialogue turning up.
Bad dialogue. Don't talk to me about bad dialogue.
And I guess that's a good segue into what I want to talk about next, which is research. Because it's a very important topic when you are doing historical fiction. To have research and to pay attention to it. I know when I was writing my book on Mary Todd Lincoln, for the 3 years it took me, for my personal reading, I only read books that were written in the mid-1800s or were about the mid-1800s, just to sort of keep me in that time period before electricity, when if a woman had to run down the street, you know, she would have all these clothes on to get in her way, all the extra things it would take to make dinner. So that was very useful. I sometimes say that I think I'm the perfect historical fiction writer because I hate research. And so I never go down that rabbit hole. I only research like exactly what I need to write the scene I'm going to write. And then also, because I don't want my books to sound like history books, I never write on the same day that I research.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because I found when I did that, I just sounded like my research. That bled into it. So I'm curious, and I would guess that many of the people in the audience who do write historical fiction are curious about how you all approach research. Do you enjoy it? Do you fall down the rabbit hole? How is it for you guys? Do you want to start, Christopher?
Well, I'd have to say I enjoy it, but I don't fall too far down the rabbit hole. I mean, you know, one has to keep going after all. I suppose for me there's kind of two levels of research. And in this book, which has quite a lot to do with wine, and I did some very nice research. No, I mean the book research. I did the other kind too. There's sort of broadly, I like to know, but my books have to do largely with kind of agriculture. I like to know what's being planted. I like to know what the work is. So I did quite a bit on that. But then there's another kind of research, which is, depends how granular your fiction really gets, that really wants to know how much did it cost to take a such and such bus, in Paris from here to there. And I like to say what it is. I like to know what a tractor cost in 1936. It just seems part of the sort of the morality of the thing, honestly. So the two absolute go-tos in my research were Baedekers. Guides, one from Paris in 1892 and one from southern France in 1893. So it was just absolutely wonderful. I didn't need the internet one bit.
Wow. All right, what about you two?
Well, I went down the rabbit hole. But
says the Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah, right. I should just write a history book. But, some of you may be wondering why Cincinnati. It is not the most glamorous place. It is not the Midi. It is not Malaysia. But, in Cincinnati in the early 19th century was, the Queen of the West. It was where everything was happening. So my Cincinnati that's been in my brain for 10 years is a pretty, really interesting place. And luckily for me, there's all these really cool little regional museums. I mean, some of them are just tiny, and they're so happy when you come there. There's usually a woman sitting there waiting, and you drive up the hill, and you say, I hear this is John Raikin's, the abolitionist house, and she's like, it's the first person who's been here in 3 weeks. And so you're kind of an important person when you do that kind of research. And I got so I did a lot of research in Northern Kentucky, Maysville, in Washington, Kentucky, which happens to be where Harriet Beecher Stowe saw Uncle Tom, or the character that inspired Uncle Tom, being sold. So it was, they loved their history there, and I got the little Maysville Museum to be my new best friend, and we would talk at length about how long it would take to row a boat between Maysville, Kentucky, and Cincinnati, because I had to have, I was like, well, how, like, can they get there in a day? And it's like, oh, well, what time of year is it? It depends on the current. And super fun, reenactors. Reenactors are great to spend time with us. You probably did that.
Oh,
with
many
Mary
of them
Todd.
Came to my book readings when I had my Mary Todd Lincoln book.
I became a total reenactor nerd. So, yeah. And I went to they're like these Civil War roundtable meetings you can go to. You can find them online. And, there's like two women, and the rest are all guys talking about the size of their cannonballs. So, hey, I thought it was great.
Wow, that's super interesting. I want to talk to all of you about this afterwards. But, I fell down the rabbit hole too. And I think that's the wonderful thing about writing novels is that you can pursue your personal obsessions as research. That's really important. And I think it also speaks to you that you should write about what truly fascinates you. Because when you're not interested, I think the reader can tell, oh, no, this is just filler, while they're getting to chapter 3. There are a lot of things I was interested in, and I smushed them into this book. That's why there's lots of animals in the book. And I did so much research on tigers, because the book has a man-eating tiger. And so I ran off and I got hold of everything I could find about man-eating tigers in Southeast Asia. So my desk is piled high with man-eaters of the Malayan Peninsula, the interactions of this. And my mom from Malaysia comes to visit me, and she says, why are you doing this gruesome book? She literally says, why don't you write something uplifting? It isn't very nice, but it is super interesting. And, one of the things I did find out was, for example, like in Malaysia and large parts of Southeast Asia, the tiger has a reverence accorded to it because it is the largest predator. But because of that, it is not the only large predator. We actually have more leopards than tigers. And even if you go back to the late 1800s or the early 19th century and you read the newspapers and microfiche, there's always animal interactions, like people getting killed by crocodiles, like taken away by python, and tigers. But most of those killings, apparently, were done by leopards. But even back then, it was considered, oh, it's much better to say that it was taken by a tiger, which has this mystique and kind of royalty, than that you were dragged off into the jungle by a leopard, which is a little bit smaller. So it's really interesting, and how we were talking about historical fiction and how it reflects our present-day society. I think in some ways humans have been the same all through the ages. You know, we repeat, unfortunately, the same mistakes, and we also have the same hopes and aspirations. So, you know, this aspirational fact, like, oh, it's better be taken by a tiger, you know, because tiger's better. So, you know, that was super interesting to me. But yes, the research is interesting. The other question that perhaps I should ask you guys is, how do you decide how much of your original research to incorporate so as not to bore your readers? Because there is some balance, and knowing the cost of things, the price of things, that time it took to go to places gives, I think it gives the novel a great deal of grounding and reality. But there's always a balance.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Do you guys have thoughts on how much did you set aside? You must have set aside a lot.
I set aside a lot. I'm fortunate that I've been in a writing group for 27 years, and they are really good readers, and they will tell me, they'll say that, you know, you need to leave that in because you have to give, like, I would think everybody knew this history, and they don't, and so they would want the history back in, but you don't want it to read like as a travelogue, right? And you don't, you know, sometimes I do read historic fiction, and I think this, I can tell this author fell in love with the recipe for soap, and has to share it with us, you just want to watercolor it a little bit in, enough to, what is the word? Verisimilitude.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I have the benefit of the curse, I'm not sure which, of having a wife who's also a writer and a rather firm critic. So my first reading, one of the few readings I sort of share with anyone, I'm kind of private about it, but she can be merciless. Mm. So, you know, it gets stripped back, the stuff I love sometimes.
Yeah. I asked before the panel, I asked all these writers to think about what their favorite historical novels are to share with you. So now you're remembering I asked you that. And since we are, you know, a room full of readers of historical fiction, what recommendations do you have for us for historical novels that you love?
I hear Christopher Tillman and Yangtze Chu have amazing historical novels
now. Oh, the most diplomatic person on the panel.
Which I'm going to acquire after this panel. I just recently got to interview Janet Fitch, and I really enjoyed her book, which was The Revolution of Marina M. It's an 800-page novel, but it really took me back to the Bolshevik Revolution, and I thought it was an amazing feat. More apropos, when I think historic fiction, which I don't generally choose because it is that, but I loved E.L. Doctorow's The March. And then I love Geraldine Brooks, who wrote March. So, and there's so many others. But, you know, I don't know if Edith Wharton is a historical fiction writer. She was born like writing a little bit backwards. Yeah. But I have to say I keep going back to her writing often to understand structure, art, craft.
Right. You know, and on some level, I mean, almost every writer is a writer of historical fiction because it takes so damn long for your book to come out. That, you know, even if you're writing about present day, unless you're writing about the future, you know, it's you're going to write things and then they're just going to be dated when your book comes out. Yeah. All right. Some more recommendations.
Actually, there's lots of great historical fiction, but two I can think of the top of my head is one is The Girl Who Played Go by Shan Sa, and that is not connected with people with dragon tattoos. It's a novel that's set, I think, in Manchuria in the 1930s. It's an explosive story of a Japanese soldier and a Chinese girl who play this game Go, which is like I don't know. It's kind of like it's like a land claiming board game. And while the board game plays out, you know that that two countries are heading into war. It does not end well, but it's a good novel. And another novel, which I think of actually as sort of a historical novel, is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. Mm-hmm. You know, a book that I fell in love with as soon as I saw it with its really cool black cover in a bookstore, and I rushed home and I bought it without even knowing what it was. And my husband's like, "What is this thing sitting on our dining table?" It is fantasy, but it is done so well, you know, and it is set so very much in and of its time that I feel it stands as historical fiction as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great! Thank you.
Yeah, well, I've already said my favorite, which is War and Peace, after all, the historical novel, to end all historical novels. But I was thinking about more recently, and also thinking about historical fiction that has worked with graduates and undergraduates in this case. One of them, E.L. Doctorow's, but in this case, Ragtime, just a marvelous book. I think one of our former students, Edward P. Jones, The Known World, about black families owning slaves in Virginia in the 1830s. And Susan Sontag's The Volcano Lover, I'll go back to every time. That's Naples in 1400, but wonderful, wonderful book. It's such a surprise for her. She wrote nothing else like it. Huge book.
Thank you all. My final question for you, before I open it up to all of you, is a question that probably the most frequent question I get when I'm in front of an audience, which is, what is your writing process? Sometimes I think aspiring writers believe that if they do whatever it is you do, they will get their book published. And I always have to admit, when I get asked this question, I'm always tempted to say, well, every day I sit down in front of my computer and make stuff up. And that is, in the end, my process. But it's my belief that every writer has to come up with a process that works for them. And that this process is usually different for every writer and for every book you approach. I think, you know, those of us who have done multiple books, we know every book requires something else. And I do think, though, even though we all need our own process, there is something to be learned from how other writers work, how they trick themselves into sitting down in front of that computer and making things up. So I'll pose the question to the three of you. What is your writing process?
Well, it's changed over time. I started writing when my children were extremely young, and so I was able to get up at 5 in the morning, and I'd write, and then they'd get up, and then they'd leave. And it was just a much more disciplined time. Now that they're gone from the house, I find it's more challenging. And, you know, the world keeps pressing in. But my husband, who's here today, built me a writer's studio that's away from our house. It's a shed, and it's made for somebody with ADD. And so I go out to the shed, and unfortunately I have internet, so I play a game on my phone for about 20 minutes, and then I have to set that aside. And then if I'm very fortunate, I get a few days of writing. It's really, I can't say I have a process. I don't do a dance. I don't change my clothes. I don't do anything like that, but it's time, and it's really time with your thoughts, like a dog that circles around before it plunks down. I think that takes sometimes a whole morning. It might take a day. But if you can get the time so that whatever you've put on the page has a chance to percolate and suggest something back to you, that's the challenge. And it's just, I always say to people, just get something on the page. It's not writing if it's in your head. So
that's a good slogan. Actually, we should all have. It's not writing if it's in your head. All right, I believe you're next.
I think what Terry said about trying to find space to write is really important, and it's not just physical space, although that does help. It helps being away from like hordes of screaming children and Lego, you know, that's really, but it is perhaps the creative and emotional space to clear your mind of thoughts. And I like what you said, Janice, as well, when you said that you try not to write when you've done historical research, because that's happened to me too. You find yourself, especially if you've been reading Victorian literature, writing these incredibly long pedantic sentences, and then you think, oh yeah, Dickens, he was paid by the word, I think. So know, so these, I think it is creating some kind of space in your head to be able to make another world, a different world. And that is sometimes very challenging and other times very easy. You know, when you are in the flow, things come fast. And some, I write in fits and starts. I wish I were more disciplined. At one point, I heard that Graham Greene wrote 300 words a day. And so that's why I tell myself, so 300 is sort of okay, you know. And if you can get to 300 and you go over it, and you can sort of pat yourself on the back and say, whoopee. So that's what I aim for. Most often, it doesn't happen. One of the most useful things that I heard about was you should stop when you're doing well and don't write out every impulse, because then you come back a day later and you're like, I've done everything, I'm at an impasse, and okay, I must eat more chocolate. So I do eat a lot. It is my inspiration. That's perhaps bad, because I've been lately told that my sugar levels are too high. But one has to do something. You know, you have to do something in order to get yourself started again. It's like pushing a boxcar up the hill, and sometimes it goes fast. So you have to remind yourself to stop at an easy place. Otherwise, if you stop when you were pushing it up with your head, you may not start again. And that happened to me. Like, during both novels, I actually stopped for long periods, like 6 months, 8 months, because I thought, like, who is the fool who brought the plot here? And now we're stuck. Oh, no, that's me. So, yeah, I think we have to, because writing is such a solitary occupation, and perhaps we're revealing a little too much about it. One has to also encourage oneself, you know, whether that's stopping at a place you can start again or eating chocolate.
Yep. I guess my answer to that is more, picking up what Yang Caesar was saying, not so much day to day, but year to year. My process is more, because I teach, is being able to write quite a lot in the summer or in breaks, and then not being able to write at all for 4 or 5 months. And it seems to me that's why it takes 6 or 7 years. But the fact is, when I started this novel, all I knew was going to send this couple to France. I had no idea. This has turned out to be a novel about a marriage, and it's getting reviewed that way, and that's indeed what it is. But I really hadn't planned it that way. I hadn't sort of thought it through. And so I would get to a certain stage in 2014, and then I would teach for 4 months. And also, it just, you know, lest it sound like I'm complaining, I'm not. I love teaching. And in fact, I just can't resist saying that two of our former students have just come in, and that little voice you heard was, I think, their daughter. It is daughter, right? So that's the pleasure. I get to be with young writers, but also let my story percolate. And when I go back to it, I'm refreshed.
Thank you. I'm going to tell you my one tip for writing. And I don't know if you guys do free writing. I, for many years, resisted free writing. I just thought, that is just bullshit. I'm not going to do that. And then I got really blocked. And a student of mine said, you should free write. It's, you know, it's like stretching your muscles before you run. Not that I personally run. But yeah. So I thought, I'm going to do that. And so I always have to trick myself. I write on Scrivener, which I think is an awesome platform, but I create a different project, and that's just for my free writes. And I tell myself two things. One, for 10 minutes, I have to keep my hands moving. And two, no one will see this. It's really useful. And I was whenever I would get stuck, like sometimes you just can't write somebody out of a room, I would go in and try to free write. I then, a couple years ago, had the idea, I'm sure I read this somewhere, that free writing first thing in the morning, when you're closest to the dream state, might be a really good idea. So I started to do that. I would like get up, not think about anything but what I was going to write. I would get coffee. But then I would sit down for 10 or 15 minutes and free write something. I was amazed at what came out. And I did a first draft of a novel in 10 months doing that. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't great, but it was there. And it was just amazing. It was almost like creating the clay to work with later was the free write. So I recommend it to anyone who wants to sort of jumpstart their writing. These morning free writes are pretty awesome. Yeah. All right, let's open it up to you folks. And we're going to have someone come around with a microphone for you.
Do you want to call on people?
No, why don't you decide?
This is for Yangtze. You talked about the house, but I kind of wondered to know more about where the story kind of became what it was. Was it the house that got you started? And then, you know, it's such a magical book, so I just wanted to know a little bit more about that.
Well, the question was about what started the novel. So the house was part of it, you know, like thinking about living in a house like that. But as I also mentioned, I put in a lot of my obsessions. And one of them was, a long time ago, I read a 1930s account of a secretive Chinese dance hall from some British guy who had gone to this secretive Chinese dance hall. And he talked about how there were all these pretty girls and they were put in a pen and you could dance with them, but only dance with them for the price of a ticket. And there were so many rumors. There were rumors about, well, these women, were they prostitutes? Were they nuns? No, actually, they were all virgins. So I thought, this is a strange job. Who was doing this job? What was the point of view of these women? And what sort of secret lives did they have? So that was part of it. And the other part of what made me think about the book is I've always been interested in mirror worlds or parallel worlds. And the fact that I think as humans, we are able to maintain two completely distinct realities in our consciousness and accept them both emotionally. So, for example, you might be a scientist and say, I'm very data-driven, and at the same time, you might have a dream one night that your grandfather who has passed away comes to visit you. And then the rational part of you may say, I don't believe in this, but the other part, the emotional part, will probably respond and say, so, what did he want you to do? You know, and this human capacity for maintaining separate realities, we actually see this, I think, every day in our societies, well, across a plethora of different ideas, was very intriguing to me. And so I put in a lot of twins and doppelgangers as well.
Yeah. And dead people.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent dead people.
I had a question for all the authors. I was just curious, Christopher, you touched on this earlier, about the response from your family and greater family members to the work you've done and if that caused any friction and actually how you dealt with that. Because I think even if you write historical pieces, there's often family members who want to think that they're in your work or are upset because they are or whatever. And I'm just curious about all of you, how you dealt with that kind of pushback.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there are always people. I used to write a lot of short stories, and every time I published one, my mother would call up and say, I did not. I'd say, Mom, is that you? You know, of course you didn't. But one of the things that happens with me, it's a pleasure, really. I have this large family and these three brothers and lots of families, and they all know all these family stories. So when I was working on The Right-Hand Shore, the previous one to this, where Thomas and Beale are first growing up and they're falling in love as children, every one of my family members who read it know that Thomas kills himself because that's what happened in the family story. So it obviously changed their reading rather dramatically, even as I was sort of beginning to suggest it actually could work out for them. They're saying, he's still going to kill himself. So it was... It was a shock to them to find out when they actually got on the ship to escape that that's what I had in mind. I would have told them in advance, but still, it didn't occur to me.
So my second novel, Good Family, was much closer to the bone with our history. And I always say it's like if you do a collage and you might take photographs and you might take magazine pictures and you cut it all up and you rearrange it into a new form of art. But some of it might say, oh, I see that. That's my mouth. or so. But that was a tougher one because people did feel the resonance of some family history. With this book, the only thing that borrowed from actual family history is the immigration of why did they leave Northern Ireland? Why did they end up in Cincinnati? And my father's second cousin lives in San Francisco, and he's in his 80s, and his wife has evidently taken the highlighter and highlighted the books. And they said, it's so fascinating. We didn't know we had abolitionists in the family. And I said, as far as I know, we didn't. But so it's interesting. I do think family does read it for, you know, they do think that they're going to somehow be explained.
Exploited.
Yanksy, did you have any family repercussions with your book?
Not really, other than subject matter and, you know, being told different things like, why don't you make it happy? But, you know, my mom is, it's hard to have family read books, yeah. I think. It's fun and it's also a little worrisome. But in my case, there really wasn't very much family history in it. Although they did try to direct me towards things like, why don't you write about this? This is good. Why don't you do it this way? So, which I'm sure we all get as well.
Yeah. My first book was a memoir. And so that's a really tricky minefield when you're writing about family and memoir and what do you want to put in and what would you leave out. I have a policy of always, if I'm going to mention someone by name or they know they're in the book, they get to see it before it's published. That does not mean I will necessarily change it, but they do get to see it. And it's my experience that people never seem to object to the thing you think they're going to object to. They object to something totally different, which is usually fairly easy to change. So it's kind of a relief to show them. But I believe two things. One, that writers should be allowed to tell the story they want to tell. And two, no one should be blindsided when they turn up in someone's published book. So I try to balance that. Another question.
We're actually recording this, so
oh, okay. Good. Yeah, that's fine. So my question is about including interviewing as part of your research process, interviewing people who knew people or who were descendants of people or who live in that area where things took place, and what that experience was like for you, if you've had that experience, if you've contemplated that experience, or if you've known other authors who have. Like, for instance, as if Doctorow interviewed General Sherman's great-great-granddaughter.
Yeah. No. I mean, this is probably not a useful answer to anyone, but I do. I said earlier, what you don't know starts to get interesting, and the fact of the matter is, in my case, this family, there are shelves and shelves of papers in the Maryland Historical Society. I've never set foot in the Maryland Historical Society. I really don't want to know. I just have the sense I get the outline, and then it's going to be mine to sink or swim, really. It's for mine to pull off as a matter of verisimilitude or to get totally wrong, but it's just kind of the way I work.
I'm going to say the only interview I ever did, and because I was writing a book that took place during World War II, there would actually be people I could interview, was my father, about what it was like to be a boy in New York City at that time. What I found useful about it was that he took me around to all the places in his old neighborhood, and he talked a lot about what he listened to on the radio. The small details that I think helps us do the world building of a different time and place. And so that was useful. But for so many of us, we write about a time and there really isn't anyone to interview, you know, because it's so far in the past. I sure would have liked to interview Mary Todd Lincoln. That would have been awesome. We have time for one more question.
So Yangtze, you brought up that the whole thing with the tigers and the leopards, and like people report that people killed by tigers were actually being killed by leopards, and you know, because it's, I don't know, you lose face if you die by leopard, I guess. But I'm really fascinated by that, and I was wondering for the entire panel if you come across anything in your research where something is just egregiously wrong, and you have like a very visceral reaction because you know better, having read more, and either like, you know, the historian was just like underinformed, or it was just written a really long time ago, or written with a particular political agenda. Like, did you come across anything that was just egregiously wrong? I was just like, no, and you felt deep in your soul like, no, but then maybe you were going to use it anyway, or mm-hmm. not.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a wonderful question. And the first question would be, before or after the book goes to press? That's the question. The things you find out after the book has gone to press, you just sort of try to pretend, you try to get over somehow. But it is a wonderful question that things pop up that just don't square, and you have to square it. As I say, I don't do sort of that much research. I mean, as a matter of just. All I'm saying is it's such a great question. I don't have an answer.
That's how good it was.
Yeah, yeah. I'm speechless.
So do I understand the question is that you find something that you say that this, not a horrible historical wrong, that you're talking about something that just doesn't jibe? Okay, because I was going to say, I wrote about slavery, and there was a lot wrong with that. So something that sometimes I think happens with other, with, you know, is that sometimes something will happen about your character that will be unveiled. So even though I had some historic facts that I would have liked to have worked in, and the timing was wrong or something like that, what I found about, so I found out something about my character very late into the novel. And I just couldn't get around it. I just thought, I thought she was this way, but she's that way. And so I just, and she wouldn't, because she's a narrator who is somewhat, she's reticent, but brutally honest, but there were things that she wouldn't say about herself in the way that we might say about ourselves in a memoir now. It had to be really subtly put in that she reveals that there's something that we didn't know, and probably she didn't even know because there weren't words for it at the time, so.
Yes, great question. And I have liked this. I've enjoyed hearing your answers. There is a difference between pre and post pub in a book. I totally hear that. Like, uh-oh, didn't know about that one. Yeah. And also, you know, I find it actually very interesting to find contradictions. You know, that is perhaps the meat of many stories. Ever since I was little, I've been drawn to strange tales in which you think you're told it was this way, but actually, you know, there never was a bridge there at all. Oh, is that right? You know, and so I actually think this is a great way to begin many stories when there is a discrepancy. You know, when the universe does not quite line up edge to edge, in that crack is where imagination, you know, flowers. And we as humans, I think, are just incredibly curious. You know, it's sort of like, you know, I read in the New York Times not too long ago about there's a bridge in Scotland where dogs apparently commit suicide. There have been many, many dogs over the last 100 years who just throw themselves off the bridge. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is so... And then, you know, my agent was like, no dog stories. No first-person dog stories. But
I think that's a guaranteed bestseller.
But, you know, it is so interesting. I think where things do not line up, that is the story, the point of tension. So thank you.
I can't think of a better place to end than that. That was amazing. Thank you all.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.